Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
I have no doubt you'll find my next guest, his life and work, and especially his journey to Christian faith, unlike any you've probably ever heard. Tony Morfitt is a man who, through his work, in one way or another, has touched most Australians. He's one of Australia's best-known, long-term and leading scriptwriters. We'd be here all night if I listed the shows he's written. Some of his top credits include Dynasty, Certain Women, The Sullivans, Against the Wind, Blue Heelers, Packed to the Rafters, and one of the latest shows to hit our screens, A Place to Call Home. Tony's been writing for almost 50 years and certainly knows the difference between documentary and fiction. But one day he became stumped, confused and uncertain. He was researching the Bible for the TV show Certain Women, and was horrified when he discovered he was actually reading a documentary, reporting history, all in one. Tony says after reading the Gospels, he wanted to go back to normal, to life as he knew it, but he simply couldn't. He'd been an atheist, but discovered the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John were too good for writers to invent. It all quite simply changed his life. Still in high demand and still writing for some of Australia's top shows, Tony Morfitt joins us now on Open House. Tony, welcome.
Hi.
So glad to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time, Tony. I'm especially curious to begin with about your transition from journalist. You worked at the ABC and the Daily Telegraph to script writing. How and why did that happen, Tony?
I've always dabbled with fiction. I started going to the theatre as a teenager and I put my foot in the water sort of trying to write verse plays in the manner of Christopher Fry. At the same time, I dropped out of university and got a job as a copy boy on the Daily Telegraph, went to cadet, and then joined the ABC Talks Department as a trainee. But at the same time, I was still writing short stories, plays, and in my 20s, I wrote and had published three novels and a series of stage plays. I had two parallel careers going on. One was in the ABC Talks Department doing interviews, which started out as mostly current affairs, but then segued into arts documentaries. And at the same time, I was sort of moonlighting, writing novels and writing stage plays.
What tipped you over into script writing then?
Well, when I was 30, I thought, I've really got to put up or shut up here. You can't be running two separate lives. And my second novel, Dynasty, was sold in the United States for, there was a bit of an advance on it, it wasn't a huge amount of money. And at the same time, on the basis of the novels I had published, I got a 6-month grant from the Commonwealth Literary Fund, I think, at the time. And so I thought, it's now or never, and quit my safe public service job and went out freelance. I then found that I wasn't going to earn a living by the novel or by stage plays, not back then. So I started investigating television drama, which was really just starting out. Crawford's had already pioneered it, and the ABC had pioneered it, and I was lucky enough to talk to John Cameron, who was then head of ABC's television drama department, about an adaptation of my novel Dynasty, which was about a media-owning family. John came aboard and we did 23 episodes, and then I did Certain Women with the ABC, and then I was launched on this career, which I hadn't really planned for, but which I enjoyed and found I was good at, because I knew how television worked from my talks department experience. And I also knew how fiction worked from writing novels and stage plays.
As I said before, it was during Certain Women that your life began to change as you researched the Bible.
What had happened was I was brought up as an atheist. I wasn't one of those kids who got sent to Sunday school. And there was no conscious religion in our household, although there was a battered Bible. And my parents had both gone to church as kids, but they'd given it away. And so I was brought up as an atheist. At some stage along the line, I stole a Gideon Bible from a motel in Brisbane. And I used it for research. But I was asked by somebody to write a documentary about why the minerals are where they are in the Earth's surface. And so the guy told me the story of the universe starting at the Big Bang. And it blew my mind. And that night, I was restless, couldn't sleep, and I had a voice in my mind saying, if you can believe all that, what's so hard about the incarnation and the virgin birth, which was a question I really didn't want to know about. So I went to sleep, and in the morning I got up and I got the stolen Gideon Bible down from the shelf and started reading Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. I was so ignorant that I didn't realize that the New Testament was a collection of books, that it was a sort of anthology. So I finished Matthew and I got onto Mark, and it was telling the same story from a slightly different angle, and then Luke and then John. And by the end of that, I'd worked very closely with both documentary and fiction over the years, and I know the difference. I'd read first century Roman literature, and I knew I wasn't dealing with that kind of novel, and I was dealing with separate sources. And I found the whole thing so convincing that I realized I believed it, including the resurrection, which is the major stopping point.
And I remember one quote of yours that you said, there are no writers good enough to write the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John.
Well, it couldn't be faked, no. I wasn't talking about prose style there or fine writing. What you're dealing with is reportage from various witnesses. It seems to me to be pretty clear that Luke, who is the only Gentile author in the New Testament, had some kind of contact with the Virgin Mary or with someone who knew the Virgin Mary very well, because we get things from Luke's narrative of the circumstances regarding Jesus' birth, which we don't get elsewhere. Matthew has a different take on it, but the two different takes on the Nativity can be reconciled, and I've done that. I did a little animation film once about the Nativity, and you can reconcile them. There are also slight inconsistencies in the various stories the Gospel writers tell, and that strikes me as being the proof of the pudding.
Yes.
That is, if you think about a court case, if all of the witnesses come in and tell exactly the same story, detail for detail, then you know the fix is in. Human beings, however inspired, will disagree about some aspects, and this is what the Gospel writers do. I just find the account of Jesus' life and teaching in the New Testament to be totally convincing, and so I had to bite the bullet, and I found myself in that awkward position of an atheist who was suddenly a Christian. And I've always been very hard on Christians. I was a sort of junior Philip Adams.
Okay.
And I didn't quite know where to turn, and so I went into a bookshop in town which was totally devoted to books about Christianity, which is a very strange sort of thing. And I discovered C.S. Lewis.
Uh-huh.
And I remembered kids at school at Parramatta High talking about a book called The Screwtape Letters. And I saw this book, The Screwtape Letters, in this bookshop, and I bought it. And that became a start of a reading exercise going through C.S. Lewis and other writers. And finally, at the other end, I took Lewis's advice and went to the nearest church. I felt I owed the Anglicans something, because when I was 19, my brother and my sister-in-law adopted a son, and they wanted to have him baptized. I'd been helped in this adoption process by an Anglican priest in Melbourne, Sydney Ball, whose parish was South Yarra. And my sister-in-law said, do you want to be a godfather? And being an arrogant young man, I was only about 21 at the time, I said, well, of course I do. You know, I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know the implications. And then she said, but when were you baptized? And I said, I was never baptized. My parents had left the church before I was born. And she said, well, you can't be a godfather. So, arrogant young man that I was, said, then I'm going to get baptized. So, off we trotted to Crosschurch, South Yarra, and the priest there, Sydney Ball, baptized me when I didn't believe a thing about it. I don't know whether it was a sacrilege or a blasphemy, but there you go.
You had quite a wrestle between what was dawning in your life as a new life and your old life as an atheist. It was quite a battle.
Yeah. I fancied myself as an existentialist. If you're in a world where there is no God, then you must make up your own rules and stick to them. So I made up my own rules, but then didn't stick to them. And I caused chaos. You know, on the way, I regret very much many of the things that happened that I was involved in before I was converted at the age of 37. But I've sort of processed that over the years, and I hope I've been forgiven for what I got up to.
So it was simply one day a decision where you just thought, I actually believe this and want to become a follower of this Jesus Christ.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. The most remarkable man in history.
Yeah.
If you think about the 30-year-olds you've been and know and have met, and then you look at the 30-year-old Jesus in the New Testament, you know something very strange is going on, because he's like no other 30-year-old you've ever met. So who do you follow? You follow the risen Lord. And in reading the New Testament, I couldn't find any point of differentiation between the miraculous side of Jesus' ministry, the healings, the nature miracles of the feeding of the people, the miracle at the wedding at Cana. I couldn't find any point of differentiation between them and the more mundane aspects of his ministry. So I figured that if you take on one, you take on the lot. It's not a smorgasbord where you can have a bit of this and a bit of that. You either take on the lot or you don't take on any.
And you're a man who is well used to making calls on what was right and what was wrong, what was credible or not believable. As a journalist, and the way through your script writing you analyse the human condition.
Yes.
So you're no fool coming to this moment.
No. Correct or not correct. I'd had 10 years in journalism. I'd had 7 years as a television drama writer. I'd been a student of the human race since I was a little kid. Someone once said to me that if you look in a playground, there are kids playing. There's one kid standing in the corner watching, who will then go home and reenact everything he's seen. That kid is the writer. You become an observer of the human race.
Do you ever have any doubts?
No doubts at all. Never have. I'm 75 now. I was 37 when I was converted. So that's half my life has been as a Christian. No, I've never had the dark night of the soul thing, because the evidence is there. People say to you, you know, I really envy you your faith. And I say to them, look, faith is the same as belief. You believe things either through evidence, and I have the evidence, or authority, or you can have a gut feeling, but the gut feeling is sometimes the most unreliable. My faith is firmly evidence-based. I've never had a twinge of doubt.
I often think no matter what we believe, it's always still an exercise of faith.
Yeah, it's either true or it's not.
Yeah. Can you describe to me how your life changed when you made that decision? How your life, how your work changed?
At first, you know, you sort of think, maybe I should write religious subjects. New converts are notoriously a pain in the ear. and so I went through all that for a couple of years. My wife, who had been a Christian since she was a child, as a child in England, she'd been told the story of the paralyzed man who's let down through the roof. She went home very excited to her mother, and she dates her conversion to hearing that word of gospel. It was difficult for her being married to a skeptic, the sort of skeptic I was. We'd had our times. As a journalist, I'd drunk like a journalist. I wasn't a violent drunk, but it wasn't a good part of my character. And I gave that up for 10 years.
How did it change your marriage?
For the better.
Yeah.
For the better. We go to Mass, we pray together, you know. It's been a very good change.
And your work, how did it influence your work, Tony?
Well, I think it makes you less judgmental. Oddly enough, I mean, people think of Christians as being very judgmental people. I don't, because I've read the New Testament, and I know that in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, judge not that thou be not judged. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. If you go in judging other people, you will be judged by the same standards as you apply to other people. Now, as a writer, I think I took sides. My writing wasn't anti-Christian, because I would happily portray Christians as decent people, flawed perhaps, but decent. But I think it broadened my view of the human race extraordinarily.
Yes.
It had an entirely beneficial effect on my writing.
Giving you deeper insights in what it is to be human, what life is about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, my wife's an artist, and she'd sort of introduced me to the idea of God as an artist. She was fascinated by the way in which you'll see patterns in marble reproduced in patterns in wood and the complexity of the creation. And I think that was part of my long walk in, to start understanding that, of seeing the world through the eyes of an artist. A writer very often sees the world through the eyes of his keyboard. to have the natural world opened up like that and understand the total improbability of that having come about by some sort of cosmic accident probably started me on the road. I think I'd come to the conclusion that there was a pattern-making process in the universe and that we were part of it.
You, more than many, know the power of the media for both good and evil.
Yep.
Do you also have a power of a scriptwriter about the kind of messages you convey in a script?
Yeah, it's a responsibility. And unfortunately, a lot of Christians avoid what you might call show business. There's a Puritan tradition in Christianity, as there is in other fields. The Green Movement is a very puritanical movement, in my view. But in Christianity, the Puritan aspect, which has always been there, has sometimes discouraged Christians from getting into the arts. When you think of Cromwell closing the theatres, when you think of Cromwell's followers smashing stained glass windows to the glory of God, there's a great deal of discouragement for young Christians to enter the arts, although I think that may be fading.
I'm sure that's right.
Yeah. Most of the actors you meet who are Christians are Catholics because they haven't been influenced by the Puritan side of Christianity.
So how do you answer that Puritan side of Christianity as one who's so deliberately and successfully over such a long period of time chosen the arts, chosen to be at the forefront of writing for very popular programs?
Paul says you should work where you are. You should be a fish in water. I mean, that's a quote from Mao Zedong, which would horrify Paul, but there you go. It's the same concept.
Yes.
After all of the turmoil of my conversion, I realized that I'd been called from a particular place in society, that is, an entertainer, and that's where I should stay. I should continue my vocation as an entertainer, but as a Christian one. I would encourage young Christians with an interest in the arts to follow it, because the history of art and Christianity in the West is interlinked. I mean, you look at the paintings of the Renaissance and the paintings of the Middle Ages, so-called Middle Ages. It's quite rare to see non-Christian works among them.
Yes.
There's an area there which should be encouraged.
I don't mean to embarrass you, but just from where I sit, I think how good it is that someone can be at the forefront of such strong culture in our community that is bearing this kind of stamp in so many of the things we see on television.
Yeah, well, interestingly, at the moment I'm working for a show called A Place to Call Home for Channel 7.
Yes.
It concerns a nursing sister who returns home after having a bad war in Europe. She'd been brought up as a Catholic, and her mother had promised God that she would get this daughter of hers to be a nun. But Sarah, when she was in Europe, met a Jewish doctor, married him, and converted to Judaism. So when she comes back, what you have is a very interesting situation where this Gentile convert to Judaism is involved in 1953 in what was ostensibly a quite Christian civilization. A lot of people went to church. In some places, you weren't very respectable if you didn't go to church. Things have changed now, but that probably means there's just a bit less hypocrisy. And in the process of this series, questions like that are explored. The sectarian issues of the 1950s. When I was a kid in the 1950s, I was born in 1938. A mixed marriage was a marriage between a Catholic and a Protestant. It wasn't black-white, it was mick-proddy. It was a very different world. There was horrendous sectarianism. But even in 1960, when JFK was standing for the presidency of the USA, his political enemies were saying, well, he'll be taking his orders from Rome.
Yes.
It's hard to believe now that this sort of idiocy went on.
But good to realise how far we've come.
We've come a long way.
What would you say were some of the values about people that are borne out in the scripts you write that perhaps make them distinctive?
I suppose in the words of the Beatles, all you need is love.
It's a good starting point.
I tend to go into areas of the power of forgiveness. Forgiving your enemies is an enormous step for you as a person, for the forgiver. It may help the forgiven, or they may reject it out of hand. But for the forgiver, it's an enormous step in maturity and freedom from the curse of hatred. I don't write messages, but I like to celebrate the better side of human beings rather than the worst side. I find a show like Dexter, for instance, which is about a serial killer who kills serial killers, strikes me as morally repellent. Or a show like Breaking Bad, where a teacher who's dying of cancer and doesn't have enough superannuation turns to drug manufacture and dealing. I find that morally repellent. Mm. These people are not heroes. These people are villains. You don't have to write that.
No.
You don't have to.
Well, I'm so glad that so much of what we've seen for decades now has borne this particular stamp. Tony Morfitt, it's such a treat speaking with you. It's a great privilege. Thank you so much indeed for sharing your life with us on Open House.
Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.